it go. I thought I'd do it in case it breaks on.
This is Thursday evening, April 30th, 1964. And we have as guest speaker this evening, Sam White, who is giving us a second to interview. This will be a second tape of his recordings. And inadvertently, we didn't have the recorder on when he started this program. And we caught it at about 11 feet on the tape, and that's why we are announcing now that his story will commence at the 11-foot mark on this tape and continue from there on.
This is Jim Cassidy.
This is Jim Cassidy.
Of the Tanana Yukon Historical Society. Taken in the Chamber Log Cabin in Fairbanks, Alaska. Ladies and gentlemen, now you will hear from Sam White, early day pioneer. Let's see, I want to continue here with something. Oh, yeah, I was taking off there one evening. It was rather poor visibility. There was a little fog on the field, and I had Sidney Huntington and a couple of other boys from Hoosier. And about twice as much baggage as anybody should have had, you know. He was crowded into that plane. And that old field was pretty short, so we started to take off, and I got to rolling pretty good, and I see a big blur in the middle of the field. And just about then, old Sidney sat up in the seat and he says, "Don't hit that bear!" It was a big bear. It wasn't a black bear. It was a grizzly. So I shut down everything and rumped on the brakes. And he didn't move. We rolled right up to him, and there was no room to go by him, so we had to turn around and start over again. And he wandered off the field with great dignity. He didn't get scared or anything. Them kind of things was happening just about every time you went into that old field at Hog River, something on that order. But when you think of anything, I'll suggest I'm running out of bear stories.
Well, tell about the trips you made up into the Arctic, Sam, too. You were flying up there a whole lot, you know, clear up to Umiak.
I flew the Army Air Corps potters, and the funny part of it was, they couldn't work in the summer. This was a geodetic potty. And it was during the war time, you know, when aircraft material was awful hard to get. And our aircraft wasn't in the best of condition. We had to use a lot of ingenuity to keep them flying. And to get up that far away from home with one airplane was fixed up that way, you know, it was pretty sketchy stuff. And it was pretty rough going up there. But the funny part was, you know, this work that they were doing, they were straightening out the map of Alaska. Because the map was in horrible shape. In fact, it wasn't any map. It just had a coastline drawn around by guess, and that was about all there was to it. There was no control work. It wasn't possible to make a map of the country, you know, then. Even as late as that. And the point about it was they had to do this work in the winter because they were shooting the stars. That was the quickest way to get control points. And they had photographs that was taken just prior to that time, and were being taken at the same time in other parts of the country from where we were working. They shoot these photographs from 20,000 feet. Well, that took quite a long time to do that because they had to have perfect weather. And to get perfect weather in all sections of the country, you know, was pretty hard. You couldn't have a cloud cover. Well, then you go to they didn't have these places pinpointed on the map because they couldn't pinpoint them because the map didn't, they had no control, whatever. So our duty was to go to these places, on a series of probably four or five photographs, and shoot the stars from that point, and then that would give us some control, and they could work several of them pictures together then, and know how to put them, and get them into a continuous picture of the country, make a map from it. And we had to do that when the stars shone. Well, in the summertime, it was daylight all day long, and the stars didn't shine. You just couldn't see them. And it was quite interesting because these fellows came from Washington, D.C., and there was a lot of names on the map, like Cairo, Black River, and they figured them were towns, and there'd be a hotel there, and all everything. We were going to stay in that hotel, and they got up here, and they conferred with me, and I told them there was nothing there, not even a trapper's cabin in most of those places, and They didn't know what to think about that. They kind of half thought I was off the track, you know. But it didn't take them long to show that that was straight goods. And then they couldn't put these places on the map, so the only thing they could do was give me a general idea where they were, and then I'd see one of these pictures. They had this stack of pictures with them, you know, hundreds of pictures. And I'd pick out a lake, and then I'd recognize a lake, and then I'd know where I'd want to go. River Bend or something, you know, talking to all on lakes, some of it was on rivers. They had a prominent point so that it would show in the photograph. Well, we wound up by taking an 8x10 tent. And one thing that worked in my favor, at least, was they couldn't work this instrument when it got down below 32 below zero, because the mercury just bunched up into a ball and wouldn't reflect the stars. And other problems we run into, they'd expect to find these lakes in a certain place, you know, and they wouldn't be there at all. They were somewhere else. So I had quite a time convincing them we had to go over another ridge or in behind another ridge to get that lake, because the lake wasn't where they thought it was in this picture. But I finally got them convinced on that. Then we went up into the Arctic where the map was even worse yet, you know. They had Chandler Lake there for one point they wanted to get. So they made up their star list in Bettles the night we stopped there. And the next day I flew up a load of stove oil. There was no wood up there, no fuel to burn, you know. I flew up a load of stove oil and tent my stove and came back to Bettles and picked up the men and went in there. And I told them my star list wouldn't do them any good and they'd better make up another one, but no, they wouldn't listen to that. They took it right off the map. It ought to be good. Good way to show them, or wasn't any good. Let them try it. And the first night we was there was a perfect night, you know, a real good night. About 20 more of my stars were out real good, no end. So they worked all night and they didn't get one star into the pool at all, not one. It was the lake was 35 miles north of where it showed on the map, and it was 15 miles east of where it showed on the map. No, it was 50 miles north and 35 miles east of where it showed on the map. So they found it out the hard way, and so after that way, they didn't bother me anymore. The next day I give them an assumed position, you know, out of my mind. And they worked out a star list on that, and without much hope, you know. Then we had to wait 14 days on the shore of that lake for another good night. We get mixed up in the grandfather of all blizzards. And you stick your head out of the tent, it was just like sticking it in a bowl of milk. You couldn't see nothing. We'd hear a big rumbling outside, sounds like a landslide, and that was caribou. Bands of caribou going by, but we could look outside and you couldn't see them. And they run right by the tent, probably within a couple of hundred feet. All you could do was just listen to them. You couldn't see them at all.
Well, that's pretty handy to have them there anyway.
Yeah.
Not hungry, you could have got something to eat.
Yeah. Of course, the Indians, they had the natives there, the Eskimos, Simon Paniak and his gang, they had a fish cache on the lake. You wouldn't do much ice fishing there. The fish are there, all right, but the ice is 6 feet thick. I never see it in the last winter time. We cut one hole through to measure it, you know. And it was 6 feet, and it's all solid blue ice. I never see any snow ice on that lake. And the top of the ice is polished, just like glass, from the smoke blowing over it with them terrific winds that get up there. And you can't stand up on it. And you can't handle an airplane on it when the wind blows. So you got to be pretty careful there. You get piled up in the rocks. No, that's on Chandler Lake, just over about 25 miles west of the pass, 30 miles, something like that. That's quite a big lake. It's quite an unusual lake, too. The natives, they used to, them were all nomads, you know, and they drifted back and forth, and they lived part of the time on Chandler Lake and then part of the time on the Killick. And they used to drift over as far as the Canning River and down to Fort Yukon once or twice in 10 or 15 years. And then Bettles once or twice in the same number of years. They live straight on meat and fish.
When did they come into that country, Sam?
Well, natives, well, I think it was when Paniak was a young man. They got away from the coast to get out of the clutches of them traders up there, you know. And the first time I ever saw them was down at Fort Yukon in 1928. They came down that winter. They landed there, well, it was 27, they landed there just before Christmas time. 65 below zero. That didn't mean nothing to them, you know. That was balmy shirt sleeve weather for them fellas. They pitched their tents, skin tents, you know, oval. Not like our tents. Out back of town, they wouldn't fraternize with the natives. They wouldn't go near them Indians, you know. Them Indians, they drew the color line right there real fine. And they wouldn't fraternize with the whites either. They just wouldn't fraternize. They pitched their caribou skin tents out there, and they had no stoves, whatever, but they were in the lap of luxury. There was wood there and spruce boughs, and that was all they required, you know. And you can imagine what them folks could do with spruce wood, dry spruce, because they can boil a kettle in 20 minutes with a bunch of green willows about that big, and I can't even set them afire with a blowtorch. He just won't burn for me. But they can boil a kettle, and that's what they do. They boil a kettle twice a day up there on the Arctic slope. They have, if they're going out for a day's trip, they carry two little bundles of them willows tied together with a thong. They boil a kettle with it. I don't know how they set them afire, but they do. That's tea. That's about the only thing that they required then in those days. The white man's grub, you know, tea or coffee, mostly tea and tobacco.
They eat all their meat raw, don't they?
Yeah, they eat it raw. They burn some of it over a fire sometimes, you know, in the summertime if they have the wood to do it with. But they just don't have it frozen raw. In fact, them white kids up at Barrow before the Seabees up there and sitting in the old signal corps there, Stanley Morgan's kids, you know, they're perfectly good white kids, you know. And mother was a wonderful cook. I used to stop there. I used to eat there when I was up there sometimes, you know. And just before dinner, she'd send me out to look for them kids. I'd find them out behind a sod house with a bunch of Eskimo kids eating a frozen raw fish just like you'd eat a banana, you know. Starting right in at the eyes and eating right down to the tail. You know? Yeah, frozen raw. Good white kids, you know, and they can talk Eskimo. They didn't want pork chops. They didn't want beef. They wanted frozen raw fish. They'd come in the house, you know, and the mother couldn't make them sit in a chair. They'd flop down on the floor and start jabbering Eskimo to themselves. But I guess they were being educated, you know, so they were pretty smart children. I don't know why they are now, but I understand the boy did real well by himself after he got out of there.
It was their father that sent the messages when Will
yeah.
Rogers
came. Mm-hmm. And the Morgan, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, has he got a store in Nome or did have?
I wouldn't be surprised. I lost track of him after.
Yeah, I think he has a store in Nome.
Were you tangled up any with the Hudson Bay steamer Baychemo?
Nope. No, I don't believe I ever even got to see that.
Well, what's the main difference in the primitives between, say, the northern coast in that tundra country between the Yukon and Kuskokwim Dalles?
Well, down there in Scammon Bay, between the two river mouths there, that is the lowest order of human life I think is on the North American continent. Don't you think so?
How about Shaglak Shlu?
Well, they ain't much better. But that down in that Scammon Bay, that is something. That is really something. That's almost unbelievable, you know. It may have improved now, I don't know.
Tell us about it.
Well, I don't know if you'd want to listen. they live half underground, you know, the pilot drifted over the top of the whole ground. And vermin ridden, you know, covered with lice. And I never slept in one of them bidakis with them or whatever it is. But some people have, you know, they've had to. I never
Which
got
area
caught
is
better.
This, Sam, you're talking about?
That's Scammon Bay.
Oh, I don't know where it is.
It's down
between the mouth of the Yukon and the Kuskokwim.
Oh, and down.
Yeah, that country's just floating there, you know. It wouldn't take much to send it out to sea.
Isn't that where they make their parkies out of salmon skins?
Yeah, they do that, and they do that up around Juneau. They used to do it up around Juneau Creek, and they used to make raincoats out of walrus intestines, too.
Yeah.
You know, and you could,
I've had one.
Yeah, you know,
they're real fine.
A good raincoat, you could hold it right in your hand like that, but if you laid it down on a stump, it would, and any dogs around would disappear just like that. You have to keep your eye on it.
Did you ever see any of good bird skin coats, Johnny?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very warm, I guess. I never had one on, but I guess they were.
You spoke about Vernon so licensed. Are the Indians short-lived around there?
Well, I wouldn't know. I wasn't there enough to see how long they lived. I suppose they would be. They must have been disease-ridden because they'd throw down caribou skins on the bottom of the floor and they'd all sleep on that in their clothes, you know. And them caribou skins would sink into the mud. And then they'd throw some more down on top of that, and that's just what they kept doing. That's what kept them from sinking into the mud themselves, I guess. Just push them caribou skins on down into mud and never see them again. That's the way they lived. But I've been borrowed, they did quite a little bit better than that. In fact, I had to stay in some of the igloos myself with people in there, you know, the owners. And it was much preferable to being outside in the blizzard. And they were friendly. They were very friendly people. Some of the things they eat, though, you know, you have to turn your back when they eat them. But in the igloos, kind of a pretty close to a comfortable freezing temperature. If you wear, you know, you wear clothes enough, you feel pretty comfortable. You get used to that, you know. You can sit around at say freezing, just a freezing temperature, and if you got clothes enough on. We started out from Barrow one time there, going over to the Killick and put in a star shot over there, which we did. And it took quite a lot of organizing. And I had a ship, the structure of which was magnetized, and couldn't make a compass work in it. And navigating up there in the wintertime without a compass is pretty rough going, you know. You couldn't make a compass work on one of them ships. Them old bus ships, they get magnetized, you know, so many bumps. You could demagnetize them, you know, if you had the equipment, but then the next two, three bumps you give it, it was magnetized again. So you just couldn't make a compass work in them. Well, we went out there, took an extra barrel of gas with us, which was thoroughly illegal, but still it was safer than going out there without any gas. And we went to Umiat, and there was no Umiat there, of course, then, just a mountain, and didn't have no camp then or nothing. I guess he didn't even know about it at that time. And we got a position there, and then we got a position up at the mouth of Killick, and then we started back. We had just enough gas, I figured that we could take off at the mouth of Killick there, and have good luck. I had just enough gas to put me in Barrow, maybe have a carburetor full when I got there. Didn't work that way. We got over the hills onto the head of the top of Gorup. We ran into a whiteout. And it just whited out right now, all of a sudden, and I was tangled up in amongst the hills. And I had seen a stretch just about 2 minutes before that I figured I could land on if I had to, but I didn't want to have to. It didn't look very good. It was a big bluff like this at one end of it, and turned out there was a big bluff like that at both ends of it, but I only saw the one. Well, we went back there. We had to have got the whiteout, you know, and we was in good position to have a crash there any minute, you know. You can't see nothing. And there was high hills around us, higher hills than what level we were flying. So I whipped her over and went down onto this stretch of river. And I landed her, and of course she went headlong into a snowbank. And I got her down, but it stopped gradually, you know, and there was no crash or nothing like that, and we didn't break nothing. We didn't even strain anything much, but there she was, buried in a sandbank, in a snowbank, and headed in the wrong direction, right up against this black rock cliff. And a turn, and a right angle turn right under the cliff, you see. So we had to stay there, I think we was there 3 nights, 4 nights, something like that. Pitched the tent, and we didn't have much stove oil. There was no wood there, you know. We dug into the snow and got a few willow sticks about that long, but we had to use them to get the plane out of the snowbank with. And we made a kind of a Spanish windlass affair, you know. It was too big a ship to handle by hand. So we put a dead man in the ice, and we got all our rope out, and I got a I twisted this rope with a stick, and we could move it about 3 inches at a time by twisting this rope up, you know, 3 inches at a time. So we was moving that ship back there for 3 days, and then after we got it moved back, we had to turn it around. And then after we turned around, we couldn't take off. Now we had to go up on the side of the mountain, about a quarter of a mile up. Pretty steep, too, so we got everything all set. And the banks of the creek were about high as these walls, you know, and it wasn't much wider than this, even a little bit. And we had to build a ramp to get up over the bank, a snow ramp. Then we pulled the camp down and we packed everything up onto this spruce spot I found up on the side of the mountain to take off. And it was a one-shot deal because there wasn't going to be any second shot at it at all, that was for sure. And we had about just about distance enough in the first spruce spot. And then we went over a drop-off, which was about 6 feet. And then there was another smooth spot that was about 200 feet. And I figured she'd be almost flying when she went over this drop-off. I had a plan for that way. And she would settle slow, and I would just hold her, you know, so she wouldn't drop. And that's just the way it worked out. And I touched my skis out here in the middle of that other smooth place, and then we was on our way. Well, I was still hoping to get to Barrow, but we used up a lot of gas right there, you see. Still hoping to get to Barrow, but figuring I'd have to be awful lucky. And we got over off the Mead River and we run into a whiteout and a good one. So we had land. And that cooked our hopes. We was finished right there for that matter. Beginning to borrow. So we just sat that one out. About an hour or so that one rolled by, went by, you know, and we took off again. And then we run into a blizzard. A real good one. But I kept going down the Mead River. Pretty soon I saw something that looked like a big smokestack sticking up out of the ground. And I blinked my eyes and I looked at it again. I knew there was no smokestacks around there. And then it looked like a pencil next time I looked at it. So then I kind of got it in between. And I knew what it was. It was one joint of a stovepipe sticking up out of an igloo. Well, then a blizzard and no more gasoline. You couldn't ask for anything better than that, you know. There was an igloo there, and that was going to be luxurious. So I landed her on the under a bank there. We couldn't see nothing, and lots of drifts around. I didn't want to wipe off the landing gear because that led to other complications. So we landed her under a cut bank, and under them cut banks, a crosswind, you know, is usually a smooth spot. So we got down there, and the engine quit, so the gas was gone, and we just coasted up right in front of this doggone igloo. You couldn't have pocketed better with a gallon of gas in it. And I tied it down, drawing the oil out, and I told the boys, I said, you go up and look in that igloo. I said, by golly, and take up a load of sleeping bags with you. So they took a load of sleeping bags and went up there, and pretty soon they come back, and they had the sleeping bags on there. We can't stay there. That's a horrible place. Well, what it was an entrance, you know, about as long as these two tables put together. And you had to go in there on your hands and knees. On each side of this entrance, they had ice blocks about 6 inches thick, you know, about as big as a section of the table like that, and they made partitions on each side. In these partitions, they had various kinds of fish segregated, blubber, and seals, and seal oil, and boy, when that hits in the face, you open that door and it hits in the face, you know, you recoil naturally, you know, you couldn't help it. So then we crawled on in there anyway, you know. I got them ahead of me so they couldn't get back out, and I made them go in. Then we got to another door. Well, that went into the igloo. And we could stand up on our knees in that igloo, and they had dried grass in there, you know, and it was dome-shaped. But there was plenty of room if you didn't mind standing on your knees. So up at this other camp where we'd run into the snowbank, we were getting low on oil, stove oil, you know. So I had rationed the oil and run it an hour a day, the stove an hour a day, and that was all. Half hour in the morning, a half hour in the afternoon. Dry the clothes and cook at the same time. They didn't dry out very good, but they helped anyway. Just long enough to make a pot of coffee for the boys. So they objected to that. It was 55 below part of the time, and that was in April then. So they wanted to burn that oil up all at once and get warm. And then freeze to death afterward. Yeah, they wanted to get warm just once. So I said, no, I said, we can't do that. Well, we'll have a shooting match. And I said, okay, we'll have a shooting match then. I said, you fellas put up the targets. And they had some targets with them. But Timothy's lugging them for, I don't know. We had a 45 automatic, one of the most inaccurate guns I guess I've ever made. So they put them up, and I said, I want to shoot first. So they agreed to let me shoot first, and I figured I could disconcert them a little bit, you know. And I got right out of business, and I made 3 bullseyes, and I said, okay, I passed the gun over to them. Well, this other fellow was supposed to be a good shot, so he was all right. But when he sees them 3 bullseyes, he commenced to shake a little bit. So he took 2 shots, and he run off 2 bullseyes just as good, and then he just fell all apart. He couldn't even hold that gun still a minute, you know. And the next one, he just held it out there, and he tried to get it on the target, and then finally he just stuck it up and fired it, and he never hit the target at all. So I won. So then we had 5-gallon stove on when we got out to this igloo, and we was there 4 days. And we'd been gone 2 weeks from Barrow, and they hadn't heard a word from us. We had a radio scheduled 8 o'clock every night, but my generator was out. The battery was dead, so when I was hand-propping, so I couldn't get them. So when we got to this igloo and got moved in there, you know, we was right 35 miles from Barrow. We was that close, you know. They were getting pretty worried about us, but we couldn't send messages. Like then, even if we'd got the radio going, and just, you know, what was going on. We had position numbers and everything in code. And anyway, we stayed in that igloo and that night, and we were pretty comfortable. And the next morning, I went out to see what the weather was. Well, that night, I brought the battery in. We set it on the stove and got it real hot, you know. Pretty near melted the case. Then we rushed it down and hooked it up into the radio, you know. And at 8 o'clock, I called Barrow. And I could even hear him breathing in the station there. Yeah. I heard him take a long, deep breath when the call came in, you know, and they talked to me just like they're talking right here. And they were pretty worried, and they said, where are you? I said, we're at the mouth of Mead River. Are you sure? I said, well, sure, I'm at the mouth of Mead River. Yeah, you know it's Mead River? I said, well, never mind. I said, tell Sig to bring 4 cases of gas to the mouth of Mead River in the morning. So they said, all right, fine. Said, we're glad to hear from you. We were awful worried. Then the dog barked, and we could hear that really sounded like home, you know. So the next morning, I went up in that igloo there, and by this time, that stuff they had in them compartments, you know, it was done smelling. You didn't smell it anymore. You could get along with it real good, you know. So I told the boys, I said, now you see, we won't run out of grub here all winter. I said, we got whale meat and sea oil and everything. And they'd almost throw up when they'd think of it. So by golly, you know, the next morning I went up and I was going to stick my head out and look at the weather, you know. You couldn't hear nothing down that igloo. There was nothing, you know. You couldn't hear a thing. It was partly underground. I went up and I got hold of this wooden door and I just unlatched it and the wind took that and out of my hands and wham, bang, you know. I thought I was going to lose it. It pulled me outdoors. And I hung on to the door because I knew I'd never find that igloo again if I ever got lost from that, you know. Boy, it was such a blizzard I'd never seen in my life. You couldn't see nothing. Snow flying and everything. So I went back and told the boys, sad news. They're going to be here 2-3 days. We were, but we were real comfortable. We burned that stove. We burned that fire and the stove, you know, at the lowest carburetor system. And to warm up that igloo, to cook our food, we'd do that an hour in the morning, half hour at noon, hour again at night, and we were living real good. But when I'd left Barrow, they told me to get some reindeer meat. And I couldn't get no reindeer meat for a while, and I told them, I said, I can't get no reindeer meat. Well, that night there'd been a bear shot, pulled a bear shot right in the village there. And I said, I can get some bear meat, good and fresh. They knew the bear had been shot, you know, because they'd seen it. No, don't get no bear meat. And I said, well, that's all we can get. So I got a hold of a friend of mine there, and he asked around. He got me some pieces of reindeer meat, you know, from that big up to a little bigger, and stuffed them in a bag. So I threw them in the airplane, which was enough for us, you know. And I told him it was bear meat. So we got out there on the river, and I cooked up messages, and I said, come on, boys, have some bear meat. Oh, no, we won't touch that stuff. And here I was eating it, and then I commenced to feel bad, you know. Gee whiz, boys, you ought to eat this stew. It's real good. Oh, we won't eat that stuff. No, not on your life. Here they were eating canned goods, sea rations and stuff like that, and I was eating stew. By golly, the next a couple of meals went by like that, and pretty soon I was telling them what a liar I was, and I was down on my knees begging them to eat it. They still wouldn't eat it. Well, that one backfired on me. Well, after that 4 days blizzard, the fourth day that cleared up, you know, it was pretty good. The wind was still blowing, but it cleared up pretty good, and right on time, Sig was out there. And he had 4 cases of gas for me. And about an hour later, we was in Barrow, and everything was okay, and we were sure soaking up the warmth, too.
What kind of plane did you use?
That was a traveler that time.
Was that 2 weeks?
No, monoplane. Six
you
place.
Had 2 men with you?
Yeah, 2 men. Commissioned officer and a sergeant. Non-com.
This igloo you were at, how many Indians or Eskimos were in there with you?
There was none in there. They weren't at home.
Oh.
They were elsewhere. Oh. They would be there later on in the spring, you know. But they had lots of grub there. It was under a bank, you see, and the wind was a crosswind. Yeah, we had it tied down. Boy, I really had that thing tied down to the ice. Froze down in every direction, you know.
You have a lot of trouble getting it started after you
get it. No, we put the fire pot under it, you know, got the motor good and warm, and took right off. One of them same parties, he's up there in the, we was up at Hound Dog on the Porcupine, and that's the cold belt of Alaska, and that was the coldest time of the year, too. And we landed on a lake there to get the stars, you know, and the weather clamped down on us. Fog, ice fog moved in, you know. And we had to wait for it. We got warmer anyway, it was 50 below, sleeping in a tent. We were pretty comfortable, though, but they weren't, but I was. And there was 1 million rabbits there. The rabbits had reached a peak right there in that particular section that year. And they were all over the place and all around that tent, and they were trying to chew off the tent ropes, you know. And we had to hang our snowshoes up. They had eaten everything, anything that they could get hold of. So the fellows wanted to know what we were going to do, and I said, I'll fix them. So we had a lot of black pepper with it, and I got melted some grease, and I fixed stirred up this black pepper into it, and then I rubbed these tent ropes with it. My God, they left them alone, too. Snowshoes, we could hang them up in a tree. So. We was there 9 days on that lake, you know, just waiting for that cold weather to go, and it got pretty tedious, you know, after a while, so I had to liven the thing up. One evening, I went out there in front of the tent, and it was in the short days, right in the coldest time of the winter. And it was, I just flashed my light, and I could see 22 rabbits right here, right in front of me. I said, by gosh, I can catch one of them and I have some fun. So I kept the light on them, you know. The first one I missed. The next one I got. I just walked over to the tent and I just stuffed him right in the flap right quick like that, you know. And boy, you know, did that tent come alive. They didn't know what it was, you know. They knocked the stovepipe down, pots and pans was flying, and this rabbit was flying all around, too. One guy said he kicked him in the chest so hard that it hurt. And they didn't even know what it was. They figured it was a lynx or a wolf. And we had to get out there and light the place up and pitch that tent again that night. And they never did see the rabbit. I came down from Circle with the dog team in March. February, March, sometime. That year was pretty tough on the old timers. They were getting old and they didn't have much money, you know. And all of them had lots of dogs. And this one old fellow there at Circle, I forget what his name was, and he had this one big dog that he really loved, you know, and he had a bunch of others, and he was going to have the others killed, but this one he couldn't bear to have him killed. And he says, I'll give you that dog. He says, if you'll take him. And I said, sure, I'll take him. Well, his dog had weighed about 90 pounds. He was a good big heavy dog. He had a head on him just like a grizzly bear, you know. And the hair on him just parted in the middle and hung clean down onto the snow. Legs, face, and all. And the only way he could see anything was shake his head, and then he'd get one eye out where he could see. So I hooked him into the wheel to see what kind of a dog he was. He told me he was a good worker, and boy, he was a good worker. But the first day, he crippled two dogs on me. He was a fighter. Boy, he loved to fight, you know. And the other dogs, I had some good fighters in the team, but they couldn't hurt him because all they get was a mouthful of hair. He couldn't even bite him, you know. So I got out of Fort Yukon, drove in, you know, and they always noticed in those days, you know, if you had another dog in your team, they all knew it. Even the kids knew it. Old Curtis, he seemed to go by, and he come running out. He said, "Where'd you get that dog?" I said, "Up Circle." He said, "How much you pay for him?" I said, $35. And I liked that, you know. He said, "How much you take for him?" Oh, I said, "I hadn't thought of selling him." Well, he said, "I got three old dogs," he said, "and I can't even haul wood with them anymore, and I need another dog," he said. He said, "I'll give you $35 for him." I said, "Okay." Stopped the team right there, just pulled him right out of the team, and he said, "Do I get a chain with him?" I said, "Yeah, you can have the chain and the harness too." So he took the chain and the harness, and the next day I see him, he said, "Damn your hide," he said. He said, "I should have known better. You're from New England, too." I said, "What's the matter, Curtis?" "Well," he said, "yesterday I had three dogs. Today," he says, "I've only got one." Well, I had $35. I didn't know how to give it back to him. Next time I went up to Circle, I gave him two-thirds of it to that old fellow who gave me the dog. He was glad to get it, too. That was a good month's pay for him, you know. But that dog, you know, he would haul, Curtis was hauling wood with him all alone, but he couldn't use them other dogs with him. That dog would work in a team where every dog got right in and worked like a devil, you know. He'd work in that, but just as soon as one of them would slack off a little bit, he'd nail him. That was what the trouble was. That Curtis team, none of the three of them could work. He figured they were right in the way, so he just cleaned them up. Yeah, there's a fight as soon as you turn your back.
Every time you pass a team, you got a ball of dogs.
Yeah. I had one like that. Killed a dog first night.
Yeah.
It's just,
no. That's haywire. That's a little
bit. I hope it ain't that night.
Wrong direction. 9:25.
Yeah.
9:25, right? I'd like to hear Sam tell some more of these stories.
Well, I can think of one more, but I think I told that from the other time, too. Well, it was about them soda springs up there in the 40 mile. I guess I told them before.
Didn't I? I don't remember.
No. Right, sure. Well, I went through there in 25 on recons. The Coast Geodetic Survey had one man with me, and we had six horses. And that was wild country then. There wasn't, when we left Shark Creek, we never saw a living soul until we got out to O'Brien Creek near Eagle 8 weeks later. Yeah, 8 weeks later. There was a mine running there, and they had a crew. Well, we kept running into these soda springs, you know, and a lot of water bubbling up out of the ground and sizzling, you know, just like an open pop bottle that just opened. And the moose come to them, you know, and swarm. The trails radiating into them, you know, and as you got near the springs, those trails got deeper. Just like spokes in a wheel, you know, coming into a hub. And then we laid up that one of them big springs there, you know, to see what the moose did when they got there. We just climbed up in the tree and sat there. And the moose would come tearing in there, and the wolves hung out in the brush around there, you know, to catch themselves a moose, too. And them moose would come tearing in there, and they'd splash right through them mountain streams, you know, good, clear, cold water, and they wouldn't even know they'd crossed them. They were in such a hurry to get to that soda water. And they'd get to that, and they'd take one wild look all around, see if there's a wolf about to jump on them. And they'd evidently been going to that water for a day or so, because their sides was all caved in, and they was lank. And then they'd start drinking. And they'd take one drink, and you'd see their sides just expanding just like that, you know. And then they'd throw up their head and look all around, and they'd let out a burp that you could hear from here down to the International Airport. Boy, a moose is good at that. On that soda water. And then they'd take off on the dead run, you know. They're afraid of them over. They never stopped around those springs. They come in there and drink. We found several of them. One of them was in a cone. And the moose had to stand on their heads to drink it, but they'd get down there and they'd drink it, too. And we tasted the water, and it was bitter. You couldn't swallow it, you know. You couldn't hold it in your mouth. It would gag you. Bitter. The horses wouldn't drink it. And yet they'd pass up the doggone clear water, splash right through it just to get over there and get a drink. That, I guess, was habit forming or something like that, you know.
Was it hot or cold?
It was cold. Clear as a bell.
Would there have been any salt in it of any kind?
Yeah,
bitter. The only thing I'd get out of it was just absolutely bitter. Too bitter, you know, to be good. Mm-hmm. For anything, even the moose. The moose loved it. How's that?
Freeze in the winter?
That I don't know. I wasn't there in the winter. But there's a man here in town who could tell us that, too.
What creek was that again, Pat?
Well, it was not only one creek. It was a lot of creeks that had them on it. And I've heard he knows there, all of them. I know the creeks are on, too.
That's in the 40-mile range.
Well, they're on the 40-mile
yeah.
side.
Yeah.
Or those, that was on the drainage into the... South Fork, South Fork.
It'd be the North Fork of the
40
mile.
North Fork of the
40 mile.
Yep. That's pretty mountainous country in there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. There's mountain sheep in there. Yeah, mountain sheep, and I don't ever see so many caribou in the world as we see there, you know. And moose, too, lots of moose. In fact, those animals, they didn't have much fear of man because I suppose most of them never had seen a man, you know. There'd been people in there in 98 and 1900, early 1900, prospecting. They had prospected about all over there, you know. But there hadn't been any people in there to any great extent for a good many years, only just a few Indians. Then Kitchenstuck Indians and Joseph Village Indians had all died out by that time. There wasn't any of them left. I guess an epidemic got in there.
I guess there isn't anybody in that country yet, is there?
Well, no, only along that road, you know. That road goes through the Eagle from Northway. This homestead is along that road.
Oh, from the hill.
And that goes through a part of the country, you know. A very choice part of it, too.
Down the 40 mile.
It goes right crossways of the 40 mile, you know. The country looked much better before the road was there.
Yeah.
I went over it once. Since the road was there, it was the first year, I guess the road went through. I went over it. And there was a cob hid behind each bush, you know, and bullets were whistling across the road. And we saw one dead moose laying on a sandbar in a little creek, shot right through the shoulder, deader than doornail, you know, right? You see it right from the road. Whoever done it didn't want him, only wanted to do a shoe moose, you know. Well, I got into Eagle, you know, and the fellas, they knew about that moose and Eagle, too, you know. And boy, were they mad. First thing they asked me, did I see it? And, yeah. Oh, they were just mooning about that, and there were several others that had been shot the same way, you know. And I said, well, you people all wanted a highway, and you've got it, and you've got what goes with it, and you got to live with it. That was the only consolation I can give them. That one soda spring there, we found them. And that was where that mine was running there, and they had about 35 men. That's where they got the meat. They sent a man over there with a gun. 2 hours and a half later, they start a man right behind him with a pack horse. If he didn't have a moose, when the pack horse got there, well, he didn't get the hunt again. They sent somebody else the next time. But I guess most always they got the moose when the horse got there. Because them moose, they really come to them lakes.
The sheep in that country just about disappeared.
Yeah.
The war, didn't they? They're back good again now.
Are
well, you know.
Sheep back in there now?
There's a lot of them now.
You had an unbroken band of sheep from the White Mountains on the Beaver right through to the Glacier Cliffs back of Eagle. 12 Mile and the Eagle Summit had sheep on them, you know. no blank spaces in there at all, the whole doggone range.
I've heard of sheep crossing the 12-mile summit.
Yeah.
Or the Eagle Summit.
They used to go there and on the 12-mile and get them since I come to the country, you know, get them around the 12-mile. And they get them on the Eagle Summit, too.
Did they get them as late as mid-1920s there?
They got them in the early 1920s there.
Okay.
Yeah. They got them there when I first come to the country. Because when I first come here, them places were just names to me. But I used to hear them tell about them. They go out there with dog teams, you know, and bring in the sheep. But that's all broken up now. The sheep at Windy Springs on the Butcher one, there's a little band in there. And that band that hung on at Nome Creek so long, them are gone too, you know. But there's still some sheep in the White Mountains.
Yeah.
Then the next bunch of sheep you got is up in them high cliffs up there on the Salcha at the Splits.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next jump is ahead of Charlie River and the good pasture in the 40 mile. Sheep in there. Then there's nothing on Mount Sorensen anymore. At least I've never been able to find them anymore there. The next bunch is on the Glacier Cliffs. That's the terminal end right there.
Tell me, Sam, how far do moose go north on the Arctic coast now?
Boy, they go down to within 10 miles of the salt water.
Is that so? Is that a late thing? I know, I remember one of your reports said all the moose are moving north.
Yeah, they, well, at period, at different periods, the moose have been on the Arctic coast before. And the Eskimos, periodically, when they'd get real thick, the Eskimos used to go up there and get moose meat. And probably get just about all of them, you know. And then they'd go away, they wouldn't go back again there until 4 or 5 years later, the moose get in there again. But in 55, I flew there all summer long, you know, on floats. I was Umat. And I covered the whole Arctic coast there, you know. I see moose out 15, 20 miles from any place that they, anything they could hide behind.
Hmm.
Feeding in them lakes, you know. Boy, it looked funny to see them out there, too.
What did they eat? Just willows? Or
they was eating out of some lakes there then, but they eat willows and they eat all the bugs, you know, they browse. But then there's no, in the wintertime, there's no feed for them at all, only just along the rivers where there's willows. And all the brush on the side of the hills right there near Umiat. During the war, they had them killed off there. There wasn't any moose left there. They killed them all off at Umiat. And they, that was their entertainment. The fellows were flying oil in there with Norsemen from Viro. When they got them all killed off at Umiat, they'd hit the Caldwell up there at the mouth of Killick, and then they'd chase the moose down. Each time they come into the trip, they'd chase them a little further, and then they'd get them down to Umiat, the fellows would go out and kill them. But they weren't using them. They couldn't eat them, you know. They weren't fit to eat them in the wintertime. And they were feeding dogs on them, and they had them laying around the camp in piles, you know. Shame. I pretty near got myself into a fight there, you know, and talked to one sergeant about that and told him what I thought of it. Oh, he was indignant, you know. He said, "We're up here and we don't like this country." Got a war on. He said, "We don't get no entertainment." Here they had fresh milk once every 2 days from Seattle flown into them. And that wasn't like the war I fought, and I told him so. We didn't get no fresh milk. And they had moving pictures every night if they wanted to see them. And we didn't have that. Boy, he had a tough war, I'm telling you. And I told him so, too. I said, I got a little, when I listen to you talk, I said, and I take a look at you, I said, I got a little bit of contempt for your attitude. Well, the last pot and shot he took at me, he said, "We're going to shoot every damn moose that shows up down here," he says, "because that's the only fun we get." I said, "That's fun." I said, "Fun for you?" Boy, that's funny, you're a funny man.
closing before, I mean, before I close, I'd like to ask one question about this deal whereby now that I think at least the Boone and Crockett Club, which is a federal or quasi-federal organization that
determines what game is or isn't. I have decided there's only one kind of caribou up here, and I think if you've ever been down on the Alaska Peninsula, at least, you've seen probably those little runny ones. I think they're called, they used to be called rat caribou.
Yeah.
They got a pretty fair set of horns, and they're about like a deer.
That's right.
It seems to me that you could hardly turn your back on them as being some kind of a subspecies.
I'm sure they are.
I was down there 3 summers, on the coast of the Atlantic, flying them out of the Platinum and Port Muller and Good News Bay. I saw them caribou there. They were very small. But the bears, there was nothing small about them bears.
They look always small.
I got along with them bears fine. By golly, I was running into them every day, somewhere. Every day we was flying, I see from 3 to 15 of them every day. Big
ones.
Yeah,
but you were a bum. Maybe that's why.
Well, I had to land on the lakes, and put stuff ashore. And they'd be right there on the beach. They was curious, And I come taxiing in, and as I got within 100 feet of them, they'd start backing away, and then they'd go up on a knoll and gang together. It'd be 3 or 4 of them sometimes. And they'd watch us, and we'd be done loaded on the beach. And all I had in the plane was a .22 rifle, and I wasn't carrying that for bad. I was carrying that for something to eat if I got out of them.
Couldn't leave anything very long.
Boy, and them bears were big,
Those trenches they have for trails there. I went down that country with a dog in the winter, and you fall in those trenches in the winter with his wet.
They step in the same track every time. They go there for a lifetime, they step in the same track every time. And that track gets to be deep after all that. You can see the print of their foot in there. You look down from the air when the grass is wet, It looks like a tractor went there. There's 2 sets of treads. They're so wide. Their legs are just like pillars, columns. They're an enormous thing, when you look them right in the face. We had a couple of light keepers out. We put 2 men out in every camp, in every light keeper's camp. They didn't have nothing to do but show a light at night. And they get awful lazy because the weather would be bad for 2 weeks at a time, and they didn't have nothing to do. Well, I was always looking after them, and I was putting out working parties, and we had one set of light keepers out in a tent on the tundra. They put him out there with a weasel. Then the weasel broke down, and they couldn't get out there to see him, so every time I'd go by, I'd come down and take a look at him, So one morning, I went by there, and there was a big old bear sniffing around the tent, and he was as big as the tent was, And them two fellas sleeping there, because I didn't see nothing of them. And that old bear was right at the tent, Sniffing around, So I went down and buzzed him. And I got him running up the hill, and I run him over the hill and left him. And a few days later, they got the weasel going, and went down and brought them fellas in. They didn't even know I'd been there. And there I just everything but blowed that tent off of its peg, They didn't even know I'd been there. Or the bear had been there either.
That's found sleepers.
Yeah, they were impossible. They always pick some guy, that goes for that kind of stuff anyway,
Well, I followed one of those bear trails down in southeastern Alaska and across a big flat. But we went down into a deep woods, I got kind of nervous. I thought I'd better back out.
Yeah. They're not terribly aggressive, They used to come into our camp quite often, but they just saunter right on through it. They're very dignified, And when they see they're in the wrong place, instead of panicking and tearing things apart, they just put on their dignity and just stroll out as if nothing had happened, They did it every day. It's a good way to have them, too. Because they got tremendous power there. Yeah, there's quite a bunch of wolves down there, too. The 2 or 3 years that I was down there, they didn't seem to get out of hand. They hadn't got out of hand yet, but they probably wouldn't soon after,
I heard those Grant caribou were down about 2,500 head.
Yeah, well, the way they were killing them down there, And this guiding profession, I don't know, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but gee whiz, the way they're using airplanes is Terrible. Because down there, even then, that was in the late 40s, you know. And they were hunting with airplanes, and they were hood in the bear. They go out and put the hunter on a hummock, you know. And then they go and chase a bear over to him. He'd be there, all he'd have to do is sit and wait till the bear run over to him, and he'd shoot him. Great way to hunt. Chase him over with an airplane.
Big sport.
Yeah. Disgusting. Then you had bootleggers down there too, you know. Them bootleggers, boy. I don't know them fellas. You know, they didn't have a friend in the world. Them canners down there are awful good to people that does things right, you know. We could get gas from them, we'd get caught, and we'd stay overnight with them. They'd feed us good, you know, and give us a good place to sleep. They wouldn't let them bootleggers come near the place, you know, because the bootleggers, they'd, on payday, they'd get them natives drunk. And then a bunch of fish come in, they wouldn't have no help to take care of them fish, and they'd lose a lot of fish that way. And the bootleggers were stealing gas off me and Ken Armstrong. And that's the way they were getting their gasoline. They were making more money, I guess, than we were. They had a racket. I finally caught one of them stealing Armstrong's gas. I put the run on him good. I unloaded his airplane. He had three cases in the airplane. I unloaded that. And then I tried to scare him. I said, you took six cases the other time you was in here. No, I only took three. I said, well, you had no business to take any. And I said, you get that back here or I'll have the marshals out here to take care of you. But quick. He said, all right. He said, I'll be back here as soon as I can get some gas. I'll bring it back. He never came back. I never saw him again. But it was good enough, you know, to get rid of him. And we pitched a tent at Igigik. There was a bottleneck there for weather, you know. And if we was above there, we couldn't get sometimes. A lot of times we couldn't get back to our main camp, you know. That weather is terrible down there, you know. And it changes so fast. You get caught so easy. And we put sleeping bags and grub in it. And cooking kit. And a Coleman stove with plenty of blazo. I came in there one day. Armstrong and I came in there both. We stuck in weather. We had to stay there that night. There were three bootleggers and the only three sleeping bags were there. They'd eat up all the grub. The dishes had beans burned into them, you know, and the blazo was all gone. And the dishes lay and scattered all over the yard outside of the tent. And they were in the sleeping bag in the tent just soaking her up, you know. They wasn't going to get out of them sleeping.
Well, are these Eskimos or are they?
No, them were white men.
Where's that? Between Igigik and Ugashik or Naknek and Igigik?
That was on the Port Hyden side, yeah. That was between Naknek and Igigik, where we used to get stuck with the weather. The weather came in there at Igigik, you know, and shut us right off.
There's a lot of fishermen around that area.
Yeah, them fishermen are pretty rough characters too.
So. Where is them places in reference to a city we all would know?
Well, do you know where Port Mahler is? Cold Bay?
Yeah.
Port Hyden? That's along the peninsula on the west side, see? And then there's Chignik on the other side and a bunch of other villages on the Pacific side. But what happens there, they've got mountain passes, see, there's a chain of mountains runs down there, the peninsula. That's the backbone of the peninsula. And there's passes between them. Well, you may have fine weather on the Bering side, but all of a sudden the weather's different over on the Pacific side, but you ain't seeing it, see, it's behind them mountains. And all of a sudden the wind changes and that weather just comes through them passes and it can engulf you and cut you off from everything in just 3 minutes. You can hardly get down fast enough, you know. And then they have another condition there, which you get everywhere at certain temperatures, but you get it there just about all the time. You'll be flying along, and you'll look down, and you'll see a pool of fog making up on the ground. And then pools run together, and pretty soon you're fogged in, and you're in the air, and you can't see any way of getting down. But you gotta find a way. It makes you sweat sometimes, too. Changing temperatures, you know, this damp air laying right on the ground, and the ground is warm from the sunlight that has been on it. It has soaked up some heat, And then there's a changing temperature just above the ground. And then they look like pools of milk. You get that in here sometimes, conditions similar to that. And another thing you get here in the winter, which you get it there practically every day or two down there, you'll have an overcast. Maybe it's 300 feet high. Well, you can fly fine under a 300-foot overcast, you know. You can get along real good. But pretty soon you'll see a streamer come down from this overcast and hit the ground. And then pretty soon over here you'll see another streamer, and then a couple more. They come down right now and they hit the ground, and then they come together, see, like that. Well, when you see that happening, you've got to get somewhere and get there right away. One day, and of course that's noted for bad weather. One day I left the Togiak River there to go back to Hagemeister Island, the lagoon right off at Hagemeister Island. It had a name for it, but I never could pronounce it. And that was only 60 miles. We started out early in the morning, we got there late in the evening. And I don't know how many landings we made in between. We just hop up from one lake and over to another and glad to get down. 5-minute flight, 10-minute flight. You know, just, and the country there getting eaten up by dogs there. One day, by golly, that was a close one. I wasn't prepared for that, you know. We landed on one lake there, and I happened to take 22 riflemen. I went out to look around the tundra. And the Eskimos, they go over working the canneries, and they turn all the dogs loose. The dogs run the beach line, and they eat up everything washes up on the beach. And usually there's plenty in the water that time. But them dogs got their eye on me, and I guess they thought there was something more to eat, and they very crafty, you know. They just swarmed all around me, just like that, you know. And they got a little bit too near, and I had the 22 riflemen. I went to work. I had to knock over a couple of them before they changed their minds. But, you know, 50 feet, that was close enough when they was on all sides of you. So I went back to the plane, I stayed there. I didn't wander around on the tundra anymore. That was enough for me. And just right, funny part of it was, they had plenty to eat, you know. They were right just right on the beach.
You wouldn't have minded.
No, I wouldn't. It's funny that they would do that, you know. But there was a great big whale washed up there. And you fly over that whale, right directly over it on a calm day, 500 feet, and it would almost knock you out of the airplane. Yeah, and every time you fly over it, there wouldn't be a thing around it, you know. It'd be just laying there by itself, and then about 100 dogs run right out from inside of it. All over the beach. Oh, funny things happen down there.
Yeah. That's one of the strong waters is down there, too. The wolverines will dig a hole in the side and then they'll live in there. You go along and pound on the waters trying to get the tusks out, right? You get the wolverine growling inside.
Old Kenneth Armstrong had a battle down there one day.
Are there many walrus left on those walrus islands?
Yeah, I guess there is, but then they shoot them all the time, you know, and they wash up on the beach.
Yeah.
Yeah, the dead ones. I don't know. They're shooting them, people on the boats that are shooting them, you know, just for the fun of it, I guess. Because they never.
I've seen them do it.
They never take any part of them, you know.
Yeah.
They wash up on the beach, and oh boy, how do they do smell? Almost bad as a whale.
There's a lot of life down in that country, though.
Yep.
Birds,
mm-hmm.
Small animals, man, it's surprising how much
yeah.
life that
yeah.
country will support, and it's a barren country.
Two of the young pilots down there, they were out in the grass one day, you know, and I see the feathers flying out of the grass, and the wind was blowing, you know. And the grass was way up here, high in the head, you know, so I went out there, and I said, "What are you doing here, boys?" "Oh, we got a couple of geese." I said, "Yes, that would be good for the mess." I mean, look at one of them, and he held it up. Doggone thing had a bill on it that long, you know, and pick it as a needle. Hey, that's a funny goose you got there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the crane.
Oh. I guess they were strictly illegal then, too. The bear came through camp one day there, right in between the tents, and he had a cook. Italian cook, his name was Louis, I can't remember his last name, he was big and fat. And he wasn't staying in the cook tent, he slept in a tent right close by the cook tent, you know, one of them
conical tents with a center pole. And when he'd go out, he'd tie it up. Well, he heard somebody haul a bear, you know, and he stuck his head out of the cook tent and he'd see this bear wandering through camp. And I was standing with the boss up at another tent and we just stood there and watched this bear. And this old Louis, he took off for his own tent. He was pretty big around the middle, you know. And he got his head and shoulders through into the inside the tent and he couldn't get any further. So here he was, going back and forth like this, and that tent was acting like a bellows, you know, and he couldn't get out, and he couldn't get in any further. And boy, he was hollering, the bear paid no attention to him at all. Just walked right on through camp.
Well, Sam, did you ever get used to the ducks and the birds and everything tasting fishy over there?
Doing what?
Everything you eat was fishy taste to it.
Oh, yeah, everything over there.
Everything.
Yeah.
The eggs and all. Everything
yeah,
was fishy.
Everything, yeah.
Even the butter they sent up in the barrels was fish.
That's right. Yeah, that's the trademark of that country down there. You get used to it after a while, don't you? Is it like that igloo full of...
I never got used to it, though. That was a trouble.
Oh, well, I got used to that. But just the same, when you get back up here, you know, and get over, gosh, darn good bush steak, you know, without any fish in it, well, that's pretty good.
Well, I come into the model, eat a tenderloin, and I couldn't eat it. It tastes like cow. You eat that other meat so much.
I had a fella swear up and down to me there were goats over in the White Mountains. Did you ever hear that?
Over here?
Yeah.
No, that's you sheep. Some of these guys, you know, that don't know sheep. They've seen goats all over this country, everywhere where there's sheep. Yeah. And them are just you sheep. That's all there is to it. It can't be anything else.
I swear.
Well, goats up here.
I couldn't talk him out of it, though. He knew what he was talking about.
Yeah, well, them kind of fellows, you know, you don't want to try to talk about anything. The more you talk to them, the stubborner they get.
Yeah.
Well, those mountain lions that were around there a while ago.
Yeah.
When they died off, the mountain lions were gone. But they haven't. There's a crop of lake now, but there's
been no goat left. Oh,
I saw an animal that had a long sure. tail.
There's goats there, yeah.
Yeah, animal. I don't know what it was.
As long as this table. I think as long as this table.
Yeah. I guess them goats get pretty big, too.
Don't they?
You know, I know less about goats probably than anybody in this gathering here, because I don't know nothing about goats. I've seen one band of goats down in Keystone Canyon, this side of Valdez. And all the time I've been in Alaska, that's the only goats I saw. I never tried to shoot them or anything.
I never shot one. I've seen lots of them.
Well,
they're
in the
kind of
common
folks
rabbits, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think they're a coastal animal. I don't think they get in.
They go quite a ways inland.
If they get in, they don't get in as far as Durango, no.
Oh, yes.
Do they?
Yeah, they get into Durango.
I sure will.
I suppose you fellas all know about the half-breed sheep up Eagle.
Fannin sheep?
Oh, they're supposed to be.
The Fannins crossed with the Dalles. Well, that's a fact. I know because I've seen them.
We're very informal here. Don't let us interrupt you.
But they call them the, the cross. The cross between the stone and the doll makes a fan. And I've seen, the first time I saw this skin-layered eagle, I didn't know how to believe it.
You get over on the Blackstone, you get them over there.